From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
Thank you, Lynn. At 4:06, following the latest news, Kirk Heinze hosts.
Energy policy and advanced energy technology were key themes at the recent Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council's annual meeting and conference at Michigan State University. We'll discuss energy affordability, reliability, and sustainability with several conference participants, starting with the president of EIBC, Liesl Clark. We'll also meet the author of a new novel that is touted as a wickedly funny eco-thriller.
This is MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, just a couple weeks after she appeared on this program as an Earth Day panel participant, Liesl Clark is back with us, this time in her capacity as president of the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council, which happens to be hosting its fifth annual member meeting at the Kellogg Center on the campus of Michigan State University. Liesl, always good to have you on the program.
Great. Happy to be here.
Most people have an annual meeting and it's business and it's boring. You folks aren't doing it that way. I mean, you've got a major program and conference going on here. Let our listeners know what's going on today.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say it's not boring, because we do have a tendency to get into the policy and technology, and sometimes I worry that it can be boring, but it's not, certainly not to this audience. So we do our annual member meeting as a day-long event, and we have a variety of panels on the latest topics and what we think are the most interesting trends in the advanced energy industry. So just a couple of highlights from today. Our opening discussion with President and COO of DTE Electric, Trevor Lauer, and the Chairman of the Public Service Commission, Sally Talberg, to kick it off. We're joined by Valerie Brader from the Michigan Agency for Energy, who's being interviewed by one of our board members, Brian Pageau from Midwest Energy Group, over lunch. And then we'll have a legislative panel later in the day. But, you know, we are really excited to bring out a variety of different themes, such as the convergence of the mobility sector with the electricity sector, and also the incredible increase in demand from corporate purchasers and cities and communities for renewable energy.
Well, thanks to your hospitality and thanks to the help of your very capable Liz Boyd, who's just a star in communications. We're going to be interviewing three of your panelists later on in this program. But let's back up just a second. You call yourself at the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council the business voice of advanced energy in Michigan. A little bit more about work of EIBC.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So the Energy Innovation Business Council is nearly 100 businesses engaged in advanced energy here in Michigan, and we cut across the advanced energy spectrum, which I think is the most interesting thing about our organization. We seek to bring together all these different perspectives and give all of them more weight, but you'll find businesses in our membership who are large and who are small. You'll find businesses in our membership who do manufacturing, who do development, and then they cut across technology. So we've got geothermal, biomass, wind, solar, energy waste reduction, demand response, peak shaving. So really a variety of different technologies coming together to have a stronger voice at the Capitol.
And from your conference last year and this year, I mean, a major component of this, a major draw, is the networking and the sharing of ideas of people from the different sectors that you just mentioned.
Yeah, we really take that very important. We think it's really critical that there is business-to-business opportunity to engage. From the list this year to the list last year, we've grown by about 50 participants, so we're close to 200 today, which we're really excited about. And then another important aspect to the attendee list is it's probably about 75% businesses, probably about 25% policymakers or policy influencers. So the full Public Service Commission is here. We're really privileged to have their attendance and thank all three of them for that. And then a variety of Public Service Commission staff, legislative staff, legislators, et cetera.
Well, nice segue, because you mentioned legislative staff. You've got some representatives and senators here as well. But the energy legislation that was passed in December to much hoopla and a lot of bipartisan support. I mean, what is that energy legislation going to mean to the business owners or the consumers who are listening to our interview?
So a big component of that energy legislation is showing that Michigan is open for business to the clean energy industry. And that's the big takeaway for us, is that bipartisan majorities in the House and in the Senate, because of the decreasing cost of renewable energy, have made a commitment to a clean energy future for Michigan. So that's really important. The other thing that's really important is the integrated resource planning component. So there's lots of fancy words, but basically it's making sure that we are making strategic investments. And one of the things we like to say at EIBC is we don't want to predict the future. We want to enable the future. And we're really hoping that this planning process will do that.
In terms of the future, I know one thing you're going to focus on besides policy, the whole issue of the infrastructure, the grid, the things that we need to do in Michigan to make sure that we have, as Trevor Lauer might say, a flawless grid.
Yeah, so a lot of different things happening at the state level and the federal level are really shining a light on our infrastructure. And we talked about this a bit a couple weeks ago when I was with you. But the grid is another piece of it. So the grid is a really important component of modern economy, and it's a very big accomplishment. However, it has not seen the type of investment that it's needed to see over the past couple of decades. And so, you know, it certainly is tree trimming and certainly is some of those real functional pieces, but it's also smart controls and smart sensors and things like that are going to enable us to get to the grid of the future that handles both supply and demand.
Lisa, I did ask you this at the roundtable, but I'll ask you again. I mean, what are you most optimistic about when you look at Michigan's energy future?
So this is going to sound a little funny, because we look at market forces, we look at technology, and then we look at policy measures. But one of the things that I take away from this day is the collaboration. I think that we're going to be better and we're going to handle change better when there are lots of different parties at the table, parties with diverse interests. And I'm hearing a lot about collaboration when we are talking so much these days about change and about the rapid speed of change and how do we all keep up with it together. We'll only do that if we've got great collaboration.
Well, we're very pleased to be here, Liesl. An event hosted by the Business Voice of Advanced Energy in Michigan. That would be the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council. I've been talking with Liesl Clark. She is the president of EIBC. Liesl, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, he just came from an opening fireside chat on the future of electricity, technology transforming the grid, at the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council's annual meeting at Michigan State University, and we'll learn some of what he had to say. He is Trevor Lauer, President and Chief Operating Officer for DTE Electric, an electric utility serving 2.2 million customers, primarily in Southeast Michigan. It's also a subsidiary of DTE Energy. Trevor, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here today.
People might get DTE Energy and DTE Electric a little bit confused. Tell us about the work and the mission of DTE Electric.
Yeah, the electric company is part of DT Energy overall. As you said, we have 2.2 million customers in Southeast Michigan. We own generation, so we're the generation provider for those customers. Everything from a nuclear power plant to one of the largest wind developer inside of the state. We have a pretty diverse portfolio of generation assets. And then we own all the distribution assets. So we're actually, when we talk about the grid, we're the distribution entity that distributes power to the grid, to all industrial, commercial, and business customers.
Well, perfect segue to the grid. On this program, we toss the word around the grid, the importance of the grid. You talked about the grid being the backbone of what you do. What in the world is the grid?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think about the grid as what everybody's connected to. And we only have to go back to March 8th when the state of Michigan was pummeled with hurricane-force winds and 1.2 million customers lost power. We saw everything in our economy and those customers that lost power pretty much come to a stop. So the grid facilitates the flow of electricity from the generation resource into the distribution grid, and it gets it to all the customers. So I like to call it one of the real engines of progress, right? The grid is a It's a technological innovation that we still marvel at, but it's also something that we need to continue to put focus into and to renew to make sure that it meets all the needs of our customers going forward.
You mentioned in your fireside chat that most of the grid in the United States was built in the 50s and the 60s. There needs to be better communication from state to state, but there also needs to be major infrastructure improvement. Are you encouraged that Michigan can move in that direction? And what is it exactly that Michigan needs to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've been at this for a couple years working with the Michigan Public Service Commission on improving and strengthening the grid. So the first way I'd refer to it is hardening the electric grid. So what we saw were 65, 70-mile-an-hour winds come through the state of Michigan. We have to have an electric grid that can withstand the types of wind and different seasonal pressures that you're going to get put on the electric grid. That involves replacing electric poles. So we mentioned, you know, we have 1.2 million poles on our system. Right now we replace about 6,000 of those a year. We need to make sure that we're replacing those at the intervals that make sense. We have substations. We have switches. We have breakers. The electrical grid, I hate to make it sound simple, but it's a lot like the electric grid inside of your home, right? It's made up of a bunch of switches, a bunch of breakers, much bigger than what you would normally think of in your home. It requires the appropriate maintenance, both preventative maintenance and corrective maintenance, and it also involves the amount of investment to refresh that infrastructure. So as new equipment becomes available, better technology becomes available, we have to be able to implement that on our electric grid. But we have to do it all with an eye towards affordability for our customers. So one of the things that we heard the chairwoman of the Public Service Commission talk about and Lisa Clark from the EBIC talk about was there's very little load growth in the United States for electric utilities. So when we invest a lot of capital into improving the electric grid, we pressure customers' electric rates. So we have to do this in a way that works for our customers, affordability. We have to do it in a way that works for our customers in terms of reliability. And we also have to do it in a way that's politically acceptable to our Public Service Commission.
Well, you mentioned affordability, reliability. We haven't talked yet about renewable energy, but we will, or energy from renewable sources. But the new legislation in Michigan that was passed in December promises to do a lot of things. I mean, the public relations that came out of that was pretty impressive. And there was a lot of agreement that these bills were a good thing. From the utility company's perspective, this legislation, what's it going to mean to your customers?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd want to say is we'd thank the legislature and the governor for really pushing. You know, you haven't had a lot of bipartisan legislation get done inside of the state of Michigan recently. So we're really glad that this was an important piece of legislation to move forward. So first, I just say thank you for getting it done. Well, it does a couple things. So it continues the path on renewable energy. So it increases the renewable portfolio standard by another 5%. So you'll see more renewables built inside of the state of Michigan to continue our path towards a cleaner energy future and reducing our carbon footprint. It also continues the energy efficiency programs. We've had great success as utilities, not only reducing energy usage with our customers, but also doing innovative things with our customers and helping to strengthen the bond between the utilities and the customers. So energy efficiency is another great thing that came out of this. Then they ask a whole series of other things the utilities and the commission should work on together. And they were talking about some of those in there today. Performance-based rates, electrification. There's a series of other things that were included in the energy legislation that helps us continue to lead the path on where is energy going and how do we do this in a collaborative way that not only is the Michigan Public Service Commission and the utilities, but it's the other stakeholders that are interested in where we're going. So I think the legislation looked at a lot of different things. Ultimately, I believe it's going to really help our customers and the utilities in the state find that path forward for our energy future.
Yeah, and we're talking about Michigan's energy future with Trevor Lauer, the president and chief operating officer for DTE Electric. Trevor, there's a lot of talk in Washington about stepping away from renewable portfolio standards. You just mentioned that ours was increased in the legislation to 15%. A lot of states have similar standards or higher. What impact will federal energy policy have, assuming it might go in the direction we think it is, on the state of Michigan?
So federal energy policy will always have an impact on states and the utilities that operate within those states. But I think it's important to note that utility investments are usually made for a period of 40 to 60 years. So not only do we have to be successful with the administration that preceded this one, we have to be successful with this administration and an eye towards the administration that comes after this. And each administration is going to have different viewpoints on environmental policies. With regards to DTE Energy, specifically in the state of Michigan, our path has been pretty clear for years now. We have a series of very old coal-fired power plant assets that need to be retired. These assets need to be retired, most importantly, because of the age associated with these assets. And as we look to replace these assets, I'll use the same discussion we used before. We have to look at affordability for our customers. What's the best way for us to provide affordable generation for our customers and do it in a way that continues to reduce our carbon footprint and meet the environmental goals that the state and our customers, frankly, have for us? So today, you look at natural gas generation with the shale plays that have happened and the shale revolution in gas. Gas is a very low-cost commodity, and the efficiency of the new natural gas plants is very high. So natural gas clearly is an area where we need to go. And then renewable generation is also something we found huge success inside of the state of Michigan, developing both wind generation, and we have the largest solar array going in east of the Mississippi right now. So we see ourselves continuing down this path of adding more and more renewables into our mix also. So it has an effect, but I think it's somewhat of a muted effect because utility by utility, state by state, really has to determine the right path forward. That'll somewhat differ based on the age of the assets that they're dealing with.
And one thing we are hearing out of Washington, this may be more of a state-by-state phenomenon, and maybe the federal government needs to step away from the mandates.
Yes. States have to control their energy future. There is an important role for the federal government. There's an important role for regional organizations. But ultimately, as a state, and particularly a peninsula state like Michigan is, we have to be in charge of our energy future, and we have to work collaboratively towards that.
What should folks know about Michigan's energy future?
What I would say about Michigan's energy future is you've got a lot of players in that pull of deciding Michigan's energy future, working very closely together. And it's where we should be. So I think we have a collaborative relationship, not only at the legislature level, but at the utility level, at the supplier level, at the innovation level with the Michigan Public Service Commission. And that's the first thing that I think everybody should understand. To get to the right spot, people have to talk openly and they have to be collaborative with where they're going. Secondly, we have the benefit of not being a first mover. So as Michigan starts to look at some of these innovations, other states have pushed forward 3, 4, 10 years ahead of us. Well, it gives us the opportunity to avoid the mistakes they made and also bring on the best practices that we've seen them take. And one of the great things about the utility industry is we're able to reach out to our peers elsewhere in the country and understand what those best practices are. So our goal as a utility is to bring the best practices to our customers in a very affordable way that provides reliable, low-cost energy to our customers.
Well, a great continuation of the Fireside Chat at the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council's annual meeting. I've been talking with Trevor Lauer. He is the president and chief operating officer for DTE Electric. Trevor, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, another session at the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council's annual member meeting on the campus of Michigan State is entitled Cities Driving the Energy Transformation. And that session features Mayors Rosalind Bliss of Grand Rapids and Jim Carruthers of Traverse City, who just minutes before his session begins has graciously agreed to spend a few minutes with us. Mayor Carruthers, welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you, Kirk. It's good to be here.
Give our listener, for those people who have been in a cave for the last 30 or 40 years, a snapshot of your beautiful city of Traverse City.
Well, most people in Michigan know Traverse City sort of is the vacation mecca of the state. We have, you know, natural resources abound. We're on Grand Traverse Bay. We have Sleeping Bear Dunes. We have lakes and streams everywhere. We're ideal for a vacation. And many people leave the urban areas of downstate and around the Midwest or all over the world now, because we're on every top 10 list you can get on, to come to Traverse City. So we face many challenges with how we grow and what we want to do while maintaining the character of our town that keeps people wanting to be there.
One thing, and I'm very familiar with the Traverse City area, but Traverse City has been green in terms of sustainability long before sustainability even became a word. But there's an ethos up in Northwest Michigan about the environment.
Oh, well, we attract many people who believe in protecting our natural resources and the environment. We're very much a green community. We attract all sorts of people that want the easier living and the nicer living with the forests and the waters around them. And we've been very fortunate, and I've been involved for some time. I got involved in politics back in 96 when I advocated our Traverse City Light and Power, our municipal utility company, to introduce a green rate so we can put the first utility-grade wind generator in the country in Traverse City. That wind tower that sits up on top of M72 Hill, that's the first of its kind in this country, and we got it placed in Traverse City. So we sort of started the green movement, the renewable movement, back in the late 90s, and we moved, you know, all along to, in 2007, we adopted the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. In 2010, we set a renewable goal for our light and power company of the 30% renewable by 2020. In 2011, we adopted a city climate action plan. In 2011, we partnered with Cherryland Electric Cooperative to build the very first community solar project. And now, as mayor, and with the leadership of others like Mayor Hartwell and Rosalind Bliss and other communities throughout the country, we've encouraged our people to support, and we have adopted a 100% renewable plan for Traverse City.
Yes, you, Traverse City, and the lovely village of Northport, a 100% renewable plan. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it means that we're going to try to become 100% renewable. All of our electrical needs are going to come from renewable resources. We could do that through our power company. Traverse City Light and Power generates about 300,000 megawatts of electricity to meet the needs of the entire city. We're a city of 15,000 people. But the city itself, buildings, city infrastructure, we only use or need about 10,000 megawatts. So we're basing our renewable goal on our own city operations and how we can build efficiencies into everything that we do. We meet the state's – we haven't met – well, the state standard, I believe, for energy production is increasing to 15% right now. We're at about 11% at our power company, and we're working towards new power purchases or renewable programs right now to gain that 4 or 5% we need to hit the state standard. I'm hoping in the future, as a utility, we can grow that to 30 or more like we originally had planned for. But as far as the city goes, we're going to work within our own operations to try to green up and be more energy efficient on everything we do. Like I said, from, you know, energy efficient vehicles to insulating our buildings to LED light programs to, you know, whatever it takes to use less electricity. So we've set up a green team of, you know, some of our nonprofit leaders that helped us, you know, generate this, planning commissioners, downtown development authority members, city commissioners, myself as the mayor, to sit down and really to evaluate our capital improvement plan for our next 6 years and really see where we can build these efficiencies in when we're building new projects. So it's a challenge, and our goal is 2020, and it's a pretty aggressive goal, but I think we feel we can meet that through, you know, really getting the support from our community, getting the support from the other commissioners, getting the support from our city staff to really focus on this as a priority.
My guest is Jim Carruthers. He is the mayor of the lovely city of Traverse City. We're talking about cities that are driving the energy transformation. Jim, there is quite a bit of development going on in Traverse City, and I know there's some issues with how high buildings can go and that sort of a thing, but this new construction is also going to drive a demand for energy as well, but you're factoring that into your planning as well?
Well, I think with the modern building codes that we have adopted through the counties and through the state, we're seeing that already built for us. I mean, we have low-flow toilets in play, you know, shower heads that use less water, energy-efficient HVAC systems, hot water systems, that kind of thing. So a lot of the building code stuff is already there for us to use to help build that efficiency into what we create. So most new construction is going to have to meet the modern code standards. So that's a good thing in my mind. I mean, it's a challenge for others because sometimes those bring up the cost of development because it's not always as popular and it's not everybody wants it, but it's good that we're finally regulating some of those codes to make it, force it to happen. So that's going to be a big help to us as we grow because we are, I think, one of the fastest growing regions in Michigan. So I think having this stuff planned out and built in to our growth, we can, make it happen before it happens. So we're working really hard at making that work.
You anticipated my next question. A lot of emphasis on LEED certification in West Michigan in the Grand Rapids area when you're building these new buildings or moving towards LEED. A lot of upfront costs sometimes, but as a mayor, you got to look at the economic cost-benefit analysis as well. A lot of these technologies end up paying for themselves rather quickly, and after that, it's gravy.
Well, right now, renewable resources for energy production are the lowest cost right now. So they're working for us. And we do know that a lot of the, mid to larger corporations in this country, progressive corporations, are looking for cities that provide renewable power because they want to locate in areas that provide that service to them that's reliable. And we also, at Northwestern Michigan College, our regional community college, we have an associate's degree program in renewable energy technologies. So we're trying to be ahead of the curve there, too, and train young people to get into these fields, create jobs, good-paying jobs, and hopefully keep them local in Traverse City and help us to build our future through education and technology right at home.
Well, that's a question I had not anticipated because I wasn't aware of that program, although we've interviewed folks from Northwestern on water quality and all sorts of other things that they're doing up there. But, I mean, a lot of students enroll in that program, and can you give us a snapshot of what kind of jobs that they may end up having?
Well, because, like I said, because of the program at NMC and because of our growth and because of the technology changes and the restrictions, I think as we grow, we're seeing the boom, and these kids are going to hopefully be able to, or young people or whoever it may be at the college, are going to be able to fold themselves into these jobs as they are created. I mean, we're just we've been in a pretty steady growth mode, but we're sort of ramping it up, and things are changing a lot in Traverse City. So hopefully this we can just grab some of these young recruits right into the industry and pull them in and keep them in Traverse City, because that's one of our biggest issues is a lot of people leave Traverse City to get educated or to live in a big city to make more money, to have a career. It's no one likes it, but a view of the bay is still half the pay. And it's a challenge to live in Traverse City. It always has been. And we've attracted a new generation of young people who really base their livelihood on their surroundings. And Traverse City has what people want, the recreation and the natural resources. So hopefully this will help create more stable, good-paying jobs and keep them locally instead of us losing them to other markets around the country and the world.
Well, congratulations on the commitment to 100% renewable. I mean, you folks have been ahead of the curve for a long time. You continue to be. We'll continue to follow events up in Traverse City, as is our wont on this program. My guest has been Jim Carruthers. He is the mayor of the lovely city of Traverse City. Jim, I know you've got a panel discussion coming right up, but thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
The Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council is hosting its fifth annual member meeting at the Kellogg Center on the campus of Michigan State University. Ed Straub, Technical Program Director for the American Center for Mobility, is part of a panel discussion on energy, mobility, and the future of transportation. It's a pleasure to welcome Ed to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thanks for having me.
Ed, tell us, we've read a lot about the American Center for Mobility at Willow Run. It's been in the newspapers. A lot of moving pieces. Put it in perspective for our listeners. I mean, what is your mission and what is your work?
So the American Center for Mobility is a nonprofit testing, education, and product development facility for future mobility. It's custom designed, purpose designed, I should say, to enable the safe validation and self-certification of connected and automated vehicle technology. Our ultimate goal is to accelerate the development of voluntary standards for the industry.
You mentioned connected and autonomous. So what's the difference? I mean, people, we hear those words. Sometimes they're used interchangeably, but there is a difference, as I understand it, between when you refer to connected and you refer to autonomous.
Absolutely. So a connected vehicle, so it's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's vehicles communicating with other vehicles, with the infrastructure about their location, their direction, the speed, and different details of the environment. You know, so the infrastructure may communicate with the vehicle and relay things like warning about a curve coming up so the vehicle can lower its speed, or the driver of the vehicle can be alerted to lower his speed, things like patches of black ice. An automated vehicle is one that's essentially performing the task of driving on its own. Think of the vehicle being the actual driver. It's perceiving the environment, it's making the decisions, and steering, braking, and accelerating.
So even though there's this distinction, which you described very well, between connected and autonomous, they're obviously linked.
What we think is that these two technologies will move forward together for better overall product. So if a vehicle is communicating with other vehicles or with the infrastructure, that's basically another sensor, another data point that an automated vehicle can use to make decisions.
Now, we've heard about the concept of platooning as an example of that, where you'd have a lead truck. Well, you can explain to our listeners what platooning is, but it seems to me platooning would be a good example of the integration between autonomous and connected.
The advantage that automated vehicles have, specifically connected and automated vehicles, is that their reaction times are much faster than you or I as humans could have. So that allows vehicles to follow one another much more closely and then automatically apply the brakes. They don't need to see something, process it, and react. They can get the message directly from three or four vehicles ahead at the speed of radio and make a decision to all brake essentially at the same time.
You know, when we hear about these things, and you think about the human brain and what drivers typically do in their cars and what the synapses that have to occur for decisions to be made, I mean, the technology that has to go into autonomous and connected, I mean, we're not just talking about mechanical tech now. We're talking about some cognitive technologies.
And automated vehicles, what a lot of people are realizing right now is it's much more than just computer science. It's going to take a very cross-disciplinary approach to get these vehicles out into broad usage, safe usage. We're understanding more about how the human brain works and then applying that to the decision-making of automated vehicles. And we also need to consider that the transition to a fully automated road network is going to be very long, if ever. So there's going to be mixed traffic on the road for a long time. So what that means is that you and I will be driving perhaps right next to an automated vehicle. Well, we're in Michigan. Maybe you've already done it. But we need to understand and learn how humans interact with these automated vehicles and then the impact that our interaction has on the decisions the automated vehicle has. It's very dynamic.
We're talking autonomous and connected vehicles with Ed Straub, who's the technical program director for the recently established American Center for Mobility. You talked about the importance of cognitive technology. I mean, some of the new, I guess we would call them bedfellows. I mean, you've got some of the companies like Google, for example, working with automotive companies, working with engineering firms. I mean, this really is bringing together some companies that heretofore maybe haven't worked that closely together.
That's true. And I think it's going, like I said earlier, it's definitely going to take a cross-disciplinary approach. It's going to take a range of companies. It's going to take a range of expertise. our at the American Center for Mobility, our first commercial partner is actually what was announced at CES in January is AT&T. So we'll be looking at and we'll have available for our testers a private cellular network, advanced next generation technology when that comes along, so that we can look at how that technology is used by automated vehicles. We can get third-party developers to come along and work on developing new apps and other areas like that.
If our listeners were to visit the, I mean, you call it a campus or a center, what would they see?
Well, right now, they would see what's left of the 1942 bomber plant and then the GM transmission plant that was raised a few years ago. Right now, it's what we like to call a clean slate. We are designing and about to begin construction of about a 2.5-mile highway speed loop that's actually incorporating part of US 12. It's going to be broken off from public traffic, so the public traffic won't be on this anymore. But we're integrating that into a highway speed loop with multiple lanes, tunnels, various lighting that we can adjust for different times of day, on-ramps, off-ramps, different merge-type scenarios that we can test for. And that will be built and available by December 1st this year. So we're on a very aggressive schedule. Over the next few years, we are building and we'll have various operating environments in which to test vehicles. So we'll have a simulated urban environment. We'll have six-lane boulevards, complex intersections, traffic circles, simulated rural environments, residential environments, an off-road environment, as well as commercial environments, car washes, things like parking structures, and an open vehicle dynamics area to test some perhaps more aggressive maneuvers.
Well, that boggles the mind to think about. So obviously this will be developed in phases over a period of years.
And phase one, like I said, is the highway loop. We'll begin construction on that very soon and work quickly. We're also working with our partners at MDOT because a lot needs to be done, or they're doing a lot, I should say, in the area. We're out in Ypsilanti, so they're doing a lot on US 12 and wired road to reroute traffic and basically right-size it. Remember that this infrastructure was some of the first highway system in the country back in the early 40s, and it was designed for 45,000 people coming to work at the bomber plant. Well, now the plant is gone, and the MDOT is right-sizing the roadways for safer travel for the public around there.
Well, clearly a renaissance for that well-run property. Ed, when things get further along, maybe we can come down there. We'll be in touch and do a walkthrough when we've got a few things to talk about.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you.
I've been talking with Ed Straub. He's the Technical Program Director for the American Center for Mobility. He was one of the panelists at the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council.
Thanks for having me.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, a new novel is touted as, quote, a wickedly funny eco-thriller dramatizing the deadly seriousness of global warming, unquote. It's entitled Sally St. John's. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I am an unabashed fan of author Denise Heinze, not only because she's a great writer, but I'm very proud to say she also happens to be my sister. Denise, what a blast to have you on the program.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show.
Let's get right to Sally St. John's. I know it just came out. Give us an elevator speech. Why should my listeners read Sally St. John's?
Well, number one, it's characterized as wickedly funny. I hope my readers find that that's the case or else I'm in trouble. I wanted to write a novel about the environment, and I wanted to do it in a way that was satirical because I thought that might be a better way to deliver a message, so to speak. And I think anybody who's concerned about the environment, but who also likes to laugh and who enjoys a good novel, will enjoy reading it.
You know, maybe because of some of the things that are happening now, maybe we have to chuckle a little bit in order to get through what we have to get through with respect to what's going on in Washington and environmental funding.
When you are faced with such dire consequences, sometimes you have two options. One is to be totally despairing, and you'll see that in a lot of the post-apocalyptic literature. Or it can get so bad, your only alternative is to laugh. And sometimes in that moment of laughter, there's an awareness and a relief that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, there's no better time that I can recall in recent memory when a little laughter, therapeutic laughter, would come in handy. Why did you decide, I mean, you sort of alluded to it, but why did you decide, you've written a lot of fiction, you've written some poems, a lot of short stories, other novels. Why climate change and global warming?
Well, that's a good question. The short answer is I really don't know. There is a longer answer, but the creative process is so mysterious that sometimes you just can't explain it. But I think that actually goes back to my childhood, our childhood, and we were raised in the country on 6+ acres. We were surrounded by farms, but we weren't on a farm. But our daily lives involved an intimate relationship with nature. I mean, we didn't have an alarm clock. We had cows and roosters and birds. And I mean, I spent more time in trees than I did malls. And I was always running around in the woods and or next door at grandma's garden, helping her dig in the soil. And I think that that has become essentially part of my DNA. And as I've gone on in life, I realize how much I've missed that experience. And in face of the consequences of global warming and climate change, I'm wondering whether the next generation will have the opportunity to experience nature like I did. So I was in a position of asking myself, what could I do? And I'm not an environmentalist. I'm not an activist. I'm not a politician. And I'm certainly no scientist. I have no scientific background. But I'm a writer, and I can write. And so I wrote this novel.
Let's give our listeners a little bit of a teaser, like you have on your website. You have had some excerpts on there. But a little bit about the plot, to just give folks a flavor of the novel.
The novel is based on this woman's experience who was born and raised in Armada, Michigan, on a farm. And she has some career opportunities in her life that are truly unconventional. At one point, she plays for the Women's Professional Basketball League, and she finds herself at another point in her life as a madam for a group of prostitutes in inner Detroit. And then eventually, she realizes in her early 40s that she wants to start an energy company, and with the sole purpose of finding any and all alternative energies that might alleviate global warming. So on the verge of her greatest discovery, she's arrested in all places, Ames, Iowa, is suspected of being a terrorist named Switchgrass, whose purpose is to get control of all the energy resources in the country and sort of dominate the power grid, so to speak. So she is in the position of having to do, she's got her hands full. She's got to save the world and clear her name at the same time, because if this terrorist Switchgrass is not brought to justice and the real Switchgrass isn't found, he or she has threatened to detonate nuclear plants around the country. And to aid her in this endeavor, there are a cast of characters. One is a curmudgeonly gumshoe named Withers, and another is her 80-year-old Austrian born lawyer, Olga, and her assistant, a young idealistic lawyer named Bud, who is taking on his first client in Sally. And then my favorite character, Marty, her mother, who, though she's aging and has health issues, takes it upon herself to exonerate her daughter.
So all of these characters, and I take it with a good deal of comic relief in the dialogue as this apocalyptic tale unfolds.
It's a sort of a frolicking caper, and it's episodic. It goes from one adventure to the next, and until it reaches the climax at the end, of course. But in addition to the sort of thriller aspect of the novel and the overarching theme of global warming, I also take on a number of other topics that are near and dear to me, and including race relations, women's rights, aging. So I incorporate all of that into this sort of farcical setting that also is dealing with all of these very important critical aspects of the human experience.
Well, that's and you know, you mentioned literature. I've neglected to mention that you have a doctorate in English from Duke, and that you have taught at Western Carolina University, and you've also taught at North Carolina State University. So you certainly know the power of literature and fiction in general to, as Faulkner said, you know, to reveal the great verities of the human heart.
Yeah, and I'm lucky to be able to express myself in this venue because, as I said, I'm not any of those other types of professionals who can address issues of global warming. I'm a writer, and I combine that with the experience of growing up in the countryside where we actually lived on property that that allowed us to experience all the different aspects of the living world, including fruit trees. Our property was part of an orchard originally, and so we could actually graze on pears and blackberries and cherries and grapes, and then critters were all around, sometimes inside the house. So I can bring that experience to the fore through my writing in hopes that that will make an impact on what happens in terms of climate change.
Well, we've got about a minute left here, Denise. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your website, Denise Heinze, Heinze.com. But tell our listeners how they can get the book.
You can go to booklocker.com, and it's available in paperback and as an ebook.
And again, through your website as well, DeniseHeinze.com, people can go there, and they can also be exposed to some of the other things that you've done.
Oh, that'd be great. Sure. Yeah, the more readers of the different things I've written, the better.
Congratulations on the new novel, Denise. Myself and the whole family, very proud of you. And the fact that you're doing it on such important salient issues of our time makes it all the better. I've read excerpts, as you know, but I'm going to be, right after this interview, go online and grab the book.
Oh, fantastic. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my work.
Okay, well, you take care. Good luck with the book, and we'll be in touch.
All right.
I'm talking with Denise Heinze. She is the author of Sally St. John's, a new novel that involves eco-terrorism, climate change, and is touted as a wickedly funny eco-thriller.
That was Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, please visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR. May is Michigan Wine Month. WKAR's Kirk Heinze spoke with Carol Bush, executive director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council, and learned that Michigan's wine industry has an important impact on our state's economy and tourism.
So we now have 127 wineries around the state. And many people are familiar with those in northern northwest Michigan, southwest Michigan, but they're all over the state, including the Upper Peninsula. We have five wineries in the Upper Peninsula. So as far as the impact on the state, the tourism destinations in those regions, for, you know, one reason, it's fantastic for the state. Mm-hmm. Those tourism destinations see a great increase in their tourists because people are coming to visit the wineries. Mm-hmm. So that impacts their local regions. Is for hotel overnights, for restaurants, for museums, for other activities, outdoor activities, you know, the campgrounds. Mm-hmm. So It affects them locally. Statewide, there's about a $300 million per year economic impact. And actually, that's an old figure. And we know it's higher, and we're in the process of getting new data to be able to tell the story even better. So $300 million for the whole state, about 2 million tourists who are specifically visiting wineries across the state every year.
But in addition to, you mentioned Northwest Michigan and Southwest Michigan, I mean, what are some other areas of the state that are seeing some growth in wineries and viticulture?
That's what's really exciting, is that it's spreading all over the state. We have a couple of wine trails in the less famous areas. So the Southeast Michigan Pioneer Wine Trail near Jackson, kind of surrounding Jackson. Okay. There are 9 wineries there that participate. They have trail events. They work together on their marketing, and it's a great day trip to go down to Jackson area. And then in the Petoskey area, the tip of the Mitt is an American viticultural area designated tip of the Mitt, and it really does cross the tip of the mitten of Michigan, and that includes the Petoskey area, and that area is really growing. There are wineries opening up. We keep hearing about potential wineries, people who are putting grapes in the ground and potentially opening in the next few years.
Now, some wineries, of course, grow their own grapes, mm-hmm. but as you well know, some wineries source their grapes from viticulturalists.
Correct, and that's the case for most of the UP mm-hmm. wineries and a lot of wineries around the state. In fact, even those that that grow their own grapes often will source from other growers in the state to be able to make varieties that they aren't growing, for one, but also just to be able to increase their production to keep them profitable.
Speaking of varieties, are there any new ones on the horizon, or some that are the vines are growing and that will be released in the next couple of years? Anything that our listeners need to be aware of?
Michigan has been growing. We have been growing nearly 30 varieties that we know yet around the state for quite a while. Many of those have just been blended into other wines, and often are just blended into other wines. But definitely there's been an increase in plantings of Syrah mm-hmm. in southern Michigan, in southwest Michigan in particular. Pinot Blanc has mm-hmm. increased both northwest and southwest Michigan mm-hmm. especially. Those are probably the two. And Grüner Veltliner is another one, mm-hmm. very unusual, odd name, but it's something that is definitely being grown more now than it was 10 years ago.
That's WKAR's Kirk Heinze with Carol Bush, Executive Director of the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council. May is Michigan Wine Month, and for more, you can visit MichiganWines.com. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR. To hear segments from today's show and more MSU Today content, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on 94.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR.
Hot flames of fire roaring at my back. As she disappeared, but soon she returned. In her hand was a bottle of wine, in the other a glass. She poured some of the wine from the bottle into the glass, raised it to her lips, and just before she drank it, she said,